Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find a Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
We are so lucky to have with us today in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios, Kors Schultz, President and Chief Executive Officer of Teva Pharmaceutical. It is the manufacturer of about 1 in 10 drugs that people in the United States take. So this is a very, very important company to the U.S. drug industry. Mr. Schultz, thank you so much for being here. Today, Teva shares are being punished for a forecast that came in under Wall Street estimates. You have said that this is going to be a trough year for just going forward for the company. What gives you confidence that this really is the bottom?
It's also the dynamics of our revenues. We have a dynamic where we have had a very successful product in multiple sclerosis called Copaxone. This product has now got generic competition since a bit more than a year. So we have declining revenues of this product, and it was a multi-billion dollar product. So it's declining. At the same time, we've successfully launched new and exciting products, a product called Austedo for Huntington's disease and tardive dyskinesia, where you have movement disorders. And we've just launched Ajovy, which is a fantastic new product that can help people suffering from chronic migraine to reduce their migraine days with on average 50%, or for some people, 75-100% reduction in migraine. These new products will, of course, be driving increased revenues. So you could say it's really the mathematics of the slope of the decline of Copaxone versus the growth of Austedo and Ajovy. And there it's just pretty obvious, if you look at the numbers, that there's a bigger drag from Copaxone downwards this year than there's growth from the two new products. But next year, the drag from Copaxone goes down. It's like a mathematical thing. You lose like 45% every year, but the absolute number, of course, gets less and less. So that's really why.
So talk about the core generic business for Teva. Been in a decline for the industry. What is your sense of the decline, the secular decline that the market should be discounting in the core generic business and whether that differs for you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The market has, over the last, I would say, 5 years, probably halved. So the total value of the U.S. generic market has gone to half. This is not because of volume. Volume is increasing. More than 9 out of 10 products being taken in the U.S. every day are generics. So the volume has been increasing, but the pricing has been coming down. Now, when I joined a bit more than a year ago, it was quite clear to me that the U.S. generic business was in what I would call a death spiral of decreasing prices. If you're in a situation like that, then the market leader needs to take action and explain to the customers that you cannot just take prices down below manufacturing cost. You cannot sustain a business where you're losing money. So I went out a bit more than a year ago, explained to the marketplace and to our customers that we have roughly 10% of our products here in the US, where we sell billions of products every year, that are losing money. And this is not a sustainable strategy for any business.
This is really interesting, especially at a time when both parties in Washington, D.C. would like to see drug prices reduced further. How much pressure are you getting from them, and how realistic is it to you that we will see some sort of general reduction in pricing market-wide?
Yeah, of course, here we really have to remember the enormous differences in pricing in pharmaceuticals. So if you take an innovative biopharmaceutical product, it might cost something like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month. If you take a typical generic, it might cost 3-4 cents a day. So, I mean, it's a phenomenal difference in pricing that you have. And the prices we see on generics, you could say the problem might be that the price of a tablet, a generic tablet a day, let's say generic Lipitor, it drops from being, you know, 20 cents to being 18 cents, and all of a sudden it's not economical to manufacture it anymore. Same thing goes for things like anti-infectives and so on. And it's very important to have steady supplies. for the patients, it's very important to have high quality of all these very cheap medications. So I would say the pricing discussion going on in the US right now politically is not really about the generic pricing. That's so dirt cheap, actually. So it's more about quality and sustainable supplies to the safety of patients. So what we did was we said, okay, we want to be the world's best supplier in terms of sustainability of supply and quality, and it's not sustainable if we start manufacturing and selling below the manufacturing cost. We had a good debate with our customers. We went out of some products we had a price adjustment, but the most important thing, getting back to your initial question, was that this helps stabilize the whole business because we're the market leader. So what we see now is a situation where the total value of generics has stabilized. That does not mean that the individual product does not have a decreasing price as you see more competition. It just means that the new products that go off patent, where we get generics into the market, the new generics coming in offset the decline on price on the older ones, so that the total value of the market, you could say, is stable. And that's a big change.
So, Mr. Schultz, quickly in 30 seconds, what is the future of Teva in terms of products? Is it branded products? Is it biosimilars? Or is it still trying to be first to market with the generics?
It's a combination of being leader in generics, including first to market, where we're the best in the world, and at the same time becoming a leader in biopharmaceuticals. And when I say biopharmaceuticals, it's a combination of innovative new biopharmaceuticals in areas where we have expertise, such as pain, CNS, neurology, respiratory, and at the same time using this skill base to make biosimilar products in the areas we know about. So we believe with our unique, very broad skill base in upscaling, development, clinical testing, launch of products, that we have a very strong future.
Mr. Kåre Schultz, thank you so very much for joining us in studio today. Kåre Schultz is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Teva Pharmaceuticals. He joins us here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. Thank you so much.
Really interesting and important point when we talk about drug pricing and lowering the cost. The question of how do you also foster a healthy generics market at a time when an increasing number of the population does rely on this market, at a time when it's the other drugs where the emphasis really needs to be. I mean, it shows the complication of this debate.
It does, and it's just one of the many layers of healthcare that in this country we continue to debate day in and day out. So we're very happy to have Mr. Schultz here with us. Well, we have some good news coming out of Puerto Rico. Looks like Puerto Rico's record bankruptcy advanced this week when a federal judge approved a plan to restructure more than $17 billion in sales tax bonds, the biggest step yet in the island's almost two-year effort to slash its massive debt and exit court protection. To help us dive into the details here, we are joined in our Bloomberg 1130 studios by Matt Rodrigue, Managing Director at Miller Buckfire, a Stifel company. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. This seems like a very good deal for the senior bondholders. How good was it?
Thanks, Paul. Terrific question. Before we dive into the details, just taking a step back, this is the largest municipal bankruptcy exit ever. $17.6 billion, larger than the city of Detroit. There were actually two bankruptcies. There was the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico bankruptcy and the COFINA bankruptcy. This resolves the COFINA credit and really sets the stage for the Commonwealth to go forward and restructure its debt.
To be clear, COFINA being bonds that are backed by sales tax and revenues that the government gets rather than just general obligation bonds, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. COFINA is backed by the sales and use tax. And in terms of the recoveries, you know, seniors, including accrued interest, got 95 cents on the dollar, and subordinate COFINAs got 58 cents on the dollar. And, you know, taking a look at everything that's happened, you know, all of the economic challenges that Puerto Rico has had, all of the fiscal challenges, a once in a 100-year hurricane, for the senior bondholders to receive 95 cents, I think it really speaks to the strength of having good bonds, senior bonds backed by a solid collateral stream. And, you know, 95 cents. People are generally happy. There was 99.5% approval of the bankruptcy plan for the seniors.
So this has got to be a huge victory for you. You are the lead financial advisor for senior COFINA bondholders, right? And this was the largest organized group. And we know it's been like herding cats when it comes to Puerto Rico's $74 billion of debt and trying to get the different parties kind of teamed up on the same side. I'm just wondering, going forward, how involved are some of the investors who you represent going to stay in Puerto Rico, and how many are going to cash out and say, never doing that again?
Yeah, it's been like herding cats on a roller coaster. In fact,
it's really fun. You've had a great couple of years.
Yeah. You know, I mean, between the PROMESA law, which was passed, then the bankruptcy, the hurricane, deals coming together, falling apart, it's been quite a ride. I think investors are very pleased with the COFINA deal. I mentioned 99.5% voting in favor. I think their LPs, so the investors in their funds, should be even happier because they got a very good outcome. And this is very good for the people of Puerto Rico. This settlement turns over 46% of the dedicated sales tax that was previously going to COFINA to the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. That represents $17 billion over the next 40 years.
A lot of people disagree with that, though. There has been pushback within Puerto Rico saying that this is going to hamper the government's ability to rebuild going forward, just because it does take half of the sales tax revenues and puts them in the hands of the creditors. What gives you confidence that that's not the case?
Puerto Rico needs to reaccess capital markets, and this deal sets Puerto Rico up to do that. So even though it's taking some tax revenue and using it to pay bondholders, it really sets Puerto Rico up to reaccess capital markets and to raise money. There's $12 billion of new debt that was issued yesterday in connection with the closing of the bankruptcy transaction. And there's a basket of $7 billion of additional debt that can be issued right away. And that may very well be currency to resolve the Commonwealth bankruptcy. It could also be used to raise capital to do other things on the island.
So Matt, I'm sure you spent a lot of time on the island of Puerto Rico the last several years working on this transaction. How is the Puerto Rican economy right now?
It's actually doing really well right now. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that because, you know, they saw pictures of all the challenges after the hurricane. And no doubt it's been a challenging situation with the hurricane. But right now on the ground in Puerto Rico, there's a lot of private insurance money that's coming in. There's a lot of federal money that's coming in to rebuild and reconstruct the island. And there's more work than people can do. So previously there was 12% unemployment in Puerto Rico. Now it's down to 7%. There's an enormous amount of economic activity going on. And the central government is actually running a surplus for the first time in many years.
So I guess that one question I have is how much of this is reliant on the federal government continuing to release some of the funding that it's promised to Puerto Rico, and how much of this is just sort of organic growth?
So Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, and it benefits from FEMA just like any U.S. state. And so if there were a hurricane anywhere in the mainland U.S., FEMA would come in and help rebuild and reconstruct, and that's what's happening in Puerto Rico. It is an important part of the process. Puerto Rico's infrastructure prior to this was very challenged. And one of the goals with the reconstruction is to build that infrastructure back and to build it better, right? And so it's a critical part of the process. And, you know, that's happening at the same time that the PROMESA Oversight Board is implementing reforms. This PROMESA process that Congress set up is working. And, you know, the two processes are playing out in tandem, and the island's doing very well right now.
So what are the next steps for Puerto Rico and the bankruptcy, emerging from bankruptcy? The senior COFINA bondholders seem to be that issue is addressed. What are next steps?
Yeah, so COFINA is done, $17.6 billion restructured. I think there's going to be—
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're like, I don't have to touch that again.
Thank you. There's going to be a large focus in 2019 on restructuring the Commonwealth. That part of the government is still in bankruptcy, that's going to be the next area of focus.
Are you going to stay involved at all personally?
We'll see. I mean, my current assignment is done, but we have a lot of relationships and we've been involved for a long time. So,
do you think that the deal that Puerto Rico struck with COFINA is going to make it more difficult for them to strike a deal with the general obligation bondholders?
I actually think it's going to make it easier. So I mentioned there's a $7 billion basket of COFINA that can be used to issue subordinate debt right away. I think that may be currency that could be used in the GO restructuring. There's also clarity on what COFINA is going forward. It has absolute ownership of a portion of the dedicated sales tax. There's no question or doubt that COFINA owns that tax. It's been adjudicated by the Title III Bankruptcy Court. And bondholders have a statutory lien that runs in favor of those sales taxes. It's a settled question now. And I think with that question being settled, it really sets the stage to restructure the GO debt.
So Matt, you've spent a lot of time on Puerto Rico, and what, if you were to guess, is the government's 3 to 5 year plan to kind of really shore up the financial situation so that they can have access to capital, they can rebuild, they can grow? What's kind of the current thinking?
Yeah, so the reconstruction effort from the hurricane is still ongoing, and that's actually going to take up to a decade. A lot of people don't realize how long it takes to really deploy the capital and to rebuild after one of these major events. Even now, New Jersey is just winding down its rebuilding effort from Hurricane Sandy. It took Louisiana a long time to recover from its hurricanes. And so that reconstruction effort is going to go on for a long time. Also, the PROMESA Oversight Board is in the process of implementing reforms. There's still work to be done, but I think they can really set up Puerto Rico to thrive over the next several decades.
All right. Well, I guess that I'm going to have to go down and do some on the ground investigation on the beach.
Absolutely.
To make sure that it really is getting up to speed. Matt Roderick, thank you so much for being with us. Matt Roderick, Managing Director of Miller Buckfire, which is a Stifel company. He was the lead financial advisor and negotiator for the senior Cofina bondholders.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
That sinking in your stomach right now, that is the feeling of April 15th rolling around, tax season. And the question is, will your taxes be higher or lower this year? Joining us to let us know and do our taxes on air, Joe Perry, tax leader at Marcum, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. Joe, so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We've heard so many reports about tax rebates being lower, about people's individual taxes being higher in the wake of the tax changes that President Trump has made. What's the truth here?
Well, it really depends on your circumstances. I think in many cases, people will be surprised, mostly to the downside. What I realize is people forget that the withholdings that they had on their wages actually increased their take-home pay. And when you ask them, do you remember how much it increased? They forget. But now when they're getting a refund and the refund's less, they don't couple the two. So really, it really depends. You know, this year was the first year that they estimated what the withholding was going to be. And that's difficult. All these years, you knew what your income was. You could adjust the Form W-4 that has the withholding. So you could right set that. So at the end of the year, if you wanted a refund, many people use a refund as a way of savings, that would be fine. But the issue is that with the new law, you could have two taxpayers that make the same amount of money, and one could get a $10,000 refund and one could owe $10,000. So it really is disparate in where it is. So planning is important.
So Joe, planning is important, but for all of our listeners in the tri-state New York area, the high-taxed tri-state New York area, one of the big changes with the new tax legislation was the inability or the reduction, the inability to deduct local and state taxes. How has that impacted tax receipts for various entities?
Well, it's been reported by public officials that the revenues have been down to the extent of $2 billion. And I think part of it, it's being portrayed that part of it is because high wealthy people are leaving the state. You know, in our client base, we're a very large firm in Long Island, largest firm in Long Island, large firm in New York City. We don't see it in our client base. Many of our clients came to us and wanted to know the consequences of doing so. But people don't leave because of taxes. It's more about family, their jobs. So what we more see is that, you know, it's really three factors. One, revenues are down because if you look at the Wall Street, right, they had a rocky road last year. They didn't make as much money as they did. So people that worked on Wall Street actually made less wages and therefore had less withholding. We saw that when we did projections. Second is there was a double dip in bonuses in 2017. Companies decided to pay what they would normally pay a bonus in 18. They paid it in 17. Why? They wanted to take advantage of the higher rate. There was a higher rate that you get the deduction, 35 versus 21. So, and the other big factor is many people used to, you know, and we advise our clients to actually pay their estimated payment fourth quarter in December. So you would be able to get a deduction. It's actually due in January. Now, with the lack of deduction, it's only limited to $10,000, and that's state and local income taxes and real estate. So once you get past that threshold, and many of our clients are past that, which is real estate taxes alone, then you want to defer that. So, and the idea is, you know, there's talk, as been reported, I think the governor of New York is going to meet with the President Trump, and he's going to make the pitch to repeal that. The problem is there's about a $60 billion gap each year in terms of filling the gap of revenue. So it's going to be a hard sell. You need another revenue generator. So we'll have to see what happens in that regard.
So the IRS came out with a report that refunds were down by about 8% this year as a result of some of the tax changes. The Treasury Department seemed to refute that on Twitter. What's the reality here?
Yeah, I think there's really two reasons why. One is the IRS got a late start. I think that's important.
And because of the government shutdown.
Because of the government shutdown to some degree. I think also with the changes in the law and the IRS is not funded that well, it really created a problem. And we're still looking for guidance.
Well, and I wonder if something else you were talking about with companies estimating or trying to estimate how much money to withhold. Have they gotten it wrong to the downside? In other words, have they been withholding on average less than they should based on all of the changes?
It depends on your expectations, right?
Okay.
If people
Everything
want
depends.
Money during the year because you need the cash, they wouldn't get it wrong if they withheld. But if to the extent that they owe more at the end of the year, and I think more people are owing or getting less of a refund. So I think that is true. But then how do you balance it with the fact that there's less revenues that are coming in and down 8%? So I think it's going to work its way out as we progress. You know, many of our clients, there's so many unknowns in the law, it's amazing. One of the statistics is with the last act, the 86 Act, that was major, it took 12 years to get all of the information so you understood what the law meant. You know, we're getting rules that are sent to us, 200 pages, and we have to digest that and understand that. So it's really complicated. So we're actually advising our clients to extend their tax returns. So that way, as more information comes out, we're able to make the right judgments for them with them.
So what percentage of the average individual filer actually makes the April 15th deadline, and how many people just blow past it or maybe seek an extension? And are there any trends there?
Yeah, there is. The large majority like to get the return done by April 15th. Most of the time they like to file it by April 14th or 15th. They like to wait last minute. Who wants to deal with taxes? But there are demographics, especially if you're invested in financial, you have a big portfolio. Generally, you do have to wait until after April 15th.
Is your sense that in general taxes have gone down for each individual? They just might not be realizing it based on the way that the withholdings work and the rebates work.
It's an interesting question. If I had to guess, I would say, you know, generally speaking, and again, everybody's different. If you made under $200,000 and you have kids, you probably are going to do better. If you're between $200,000 and $400,000, you're probably, depends on your real estate taxes before and state taxes, you're probably just about right. And then anything beyond that, you're probably paying more in taxes. I know we did some calculations for some of the public officials. And when we did those calculations, we had their last year return, which was public. And then what we did was project the benefit. Most of them did have an average of $8,000 to $10,000 of a lessened tax, and their income was around the $200,000 to $300,000 mark.
Joe Perry, thank you so much. As we approach April 15th, maybe I'll be speaking to you before April 15th. Joe Perry, tax leader at Marcum, just kind of giving us a sense, Lisa, I think, of kind of all the changes that have taken place, with the tax code, the President Trump's tax code. I think individuals are trying to get a sense of, you know, what it means for them going forward.
How much money they have.
Yeah, how much money? I mean, am I getting money back? How much more am I going to pay? I think it's a lot of uncertainty, but we'll see. So, well, it looks like geopolitical uncertainties that have whipsawed the markets over the past couple of months are beginning to come into focus. To help us peel back that onion, let's bring in Hugh Johnson. Hugh is a chairman and chief investment officer of Hugh Johnson Advisors based in Albany, New York. Hugh, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start with China. The U.S. trade delegation is in Beijing. Looks like some progress is being made. What are your thoughts on the latest in China?
Well, I think it's, Paul, I think right at the top of the list is you have to recognize, and I think we all do recognize, that both China and the U.S., or really Trump, have a lot to lose if there's a breakdown or a failure of these negotiations. First of all, China, as you know, the economy is under a lot of pressure. They export $5 billion, $500 billion to the U.S. each year. That's an important part of their economy. They can't afford to lose that. They can't afford to have that even diminished. So they have a lot to see success. And, of course, in the case of Trump, he wants to see China import a great deal more. At the top of the list is agricultural products, soybeans. You hear about that all the time. And to him, of course, that's important in trying to secure the vote of the farmers as we look at 2020. So, you know, both have a lot to lose. I think that's the reason to feel there's going to be success. And that's also the reason why I think Trump is willing to have a postponement of that March 1st deadline. So I think we're looking at the end of March, and the U.S. might not get all of it once, but it'll certainly get some sort of a deal by the end of March, or at least in the near future. So I think those are going along. Those talks are really don't concern me. They're going along quite well, and I think the markets reflect that.
Hugh, as an investor, how much do you focus on macro events like trade talks that are on again, off again, on again, who knows again, versus just the specific corporate reports that we're getting out and just other sort of very idiosyncratic issues?
That's a great question, Lisa, and I think the answer to that question is I don't focus on the macro, sort of the political, geopolitical stuff, unless it's going to have an impact, a significant impact that I can measure on the U.S. economy and earnings on the one hand, and of course on Federal Reserve policy or interest rates on the other hand. The things that really matter to me in trying to decide whether I should be positive or negative on the stock market are really interest rates on the one side and earnings on the other side. And quite frankly, I look at this stuff, I take it seriously, but I'm only worried or concerned about it or integrate it when I can quantify the impact it's going to have on what really matters, and what really matters are earnings and interest rates.
Well, Hugh, let's go to that issue. On the interest rates, it looks like the Fed is on the sideline, so perhaps investors are maybe taking a closer look at earnings. We're about three quarters of the way through the fourth quarter earnings season. What have you taken out of this earnings season to either make you more or less constructive on the equity markets?
Well, I think you've got to take two things out. Is first of all, the earnings season was pretty good. I mean, 70% of the companies beating expectations, that part's good. But the forward guidance, as you know, is not very good. And as a result of that, both for 2019 and 2020, I've been bringing down estimates for the S&P 500. And I do that just about every day as I see a new forward guidance. So earnings estimates are coming down. The second thing is, of course, as you know, on the other side of the equation, the interest rate side of the equation, everybody's expecting the Federal Reserve to kind of hold. I expect, along with a lot of other folks, that they're going to raise interest rates at least one time in 2019. I have that at mid-year. So we've got an improved outlook for interest rates. They'll be going up, but not as much. And we have, let's say, a somewhat deteriorating outlook for earnings. The growth rate of earnings in 2019-20 are going to be a little bit softer than we had thought. You put those two things together and you say, we're okay now. The configuration is okay now. I think when it gets a little bit problematic is when interest rates get to a little bit higher level, and then we get to sort of the first quarter of 2020. Then I think the stock market is not going to have enough in the way of earnings to offset the rise that we're going to see, even though modest, in interest rates.
So in the meantime, you paint a pretty constructive picture of the U.S. economy, and as such, some of the stocks that you seem to be favoring are in the consumer staples industries as well as healthcare. So somewhat conservative, but also relying on steady growth in the economy. So which names are you looking at in particular?
Yeah, that's another good question, Lisa. To be honest with you, we're looking at kind of consumer staples, healthcare stocks, and the communication services side of the ledger. And the reason we're looking at that so carefully is because of something I just mentioned, and that is that it's clear that the economy is slowing in the process of 2019 and in the process also earnings slowing. So you try to find companies that are going to give us somewhat reliable growth rates in earnings. In the consumer staples area, I would suggest everybody take a look at Walmart. In the healthcare area, there's an awful lot of companies in the healthcare area, and in the consumer in the communications services area, take a look at the ETF, which represents the communication services. There's a lot of volatile companies in communication services, Facebook being an example. And in order to try, I think you have to get diversification. You have to have representation in communication services. But the best way to do that is to buy the exchange-traded funds. So those are three areas where I would take a very, very hard look. And I think you can buy those now in a positive equity market environment.
Hugh Johnson, thank you so much for being with us. Hugh Johnson is Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Hugh Johnson Advisors in Albany, New York.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.